Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. Broadcasting from WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. 5 years ago, on April 20th, 2010, the Louisiana seafood industry took a glancing blow when the Deepwater Horizon rig exploded in the Gulf of Mexico.
It turned out to be the worst environmental disaster in more than 20 years.
Thousands of gallons of crude oil are oozing into the Louisiana coastal waters 10 days now after that oil rig exploded in the Gulf of Mexico.
And this afternoon, rescue crews cleaned their first bird found coated with oil, which is being spilled at a rate of 5,000 barrels every day. It could take up to 3 months to drill a relief well to plug the leak.
6 weeks later, we produced our very first episode of Louisiana Eats with no choice but to focus on the terrifying situation that Louisiana fishermen and Louisiana seafood lovers alike all found themselves in. What would happen to the finfish and crustaceans that fill our Gulf waters? Would we ever eat oysters again? On that first show, Chef Frank Brightston gave us his thoughts on the situation. The intense sorrow in Frank's voice was palpable as he talked about his friends, the fishermen, and the conditions of our waterways. Today, we're looking back to that terrible time while celebrating the fantastic recovery of our seafood industry. So get ready for a dose of Louisiana seafood happiness on this week's Louisiana Eats. To understand how the commercial fishing industry was able to recover, we'll need to go back in time to 2010, when Louisiana Eats first went on the air. Here's Chef Frank Brightston talking about his firsthand experience seeing the devastation in the Gulf.
Are you able to have Louisiana oysters on your menu now?
Oh, yeah. We're still getting oysters and most of our seafoods. Oysters have gone up in price quite a bit. But we're fortunate to be using oysters that come from the east side of the river, which is where our processor harvests from. He was closed for, I guess, about 10 days early on in this mess when they shut down the east side. But the east side has been very fortunate since then to remain open and clean. So we're still getting product.
Are you forming any strategies about substitutes? What are you thinking?
Oh, yeah. I have a page full of Plan Bs, some of which we've toyed with already on our menus at the restaurants. But there's no doubt that to be successful as we move forward through this adventure, you have to be very creative and very flexible. And we hope to be able to do that.
What are you hearing from your customers, Frank?
Well, I think for our local guests, everyone pretty much understands the situation. And I think as Louisianians, we are savoring every bite of seafood as if it were going to be our last, which it won't be, I should say. We'll get through this one way or the other, but there's a lot of uncertainty in the future. And so, once again, we are experiencing adversity. And once again, it makes us appreciate the good things in life. We count our blessings more and more each day. And so that's always the silver lining, if there is one.
I know that you are a deep thinker as well as a chef, and I would like you to tell me, how is this situation really affecting you personally as well as professionally?
Well, personally, it's really rough. I've made two sort of fact-finding missions in the past few days into the marsh and the coastal areas, one to Myrtle Grove on the West Bank, and then one to Grand Isle. And I just cry. You know, my family's been here five generations, and this is the life that I know. And for all of us here, this is the life that we know. And food is such a huge part of our lives, our culture, our heritage, and for me, my business. And, you know, I get a lot of calls and questions about seafood availability, and that's a very important thing. But to me, it's not nearly the most important thing. The most important thing to me is the people, the human side of this. In Grand Isle, for instance, and in Myrtle Grove, the things that struck me first was the lack of activity. No shrimpers, no oyster boats, no sports fishermen, no boats on the road, no movement at all. It's like a ghost town. And that is painful. And talking to people in the area, you know, concerned about their livelihoods, midterm, short-term, long-term, all of it. So for me, it's very depressing, and I know a lot of people are like that. The stress, the anger, the frustration, and the depression and sadness is a very real thing, and I suppose that would be talked about at some point, but it's here now. I want my life back. Things were going pretty well. You know, here in New Orleans, 2010 was really start off with a bang. Yeah. And business has been good. The city's riding high spiritually. And as a people, we were really on the cusp of a new renaissance. And we are. And then this thing happened. But we have to find a way. And there's so much uncertainty involved with this that I think we all have to be patient a little bit. But we also have to be, as I said, be very creative in how we formulate our lives going forward.
Frank's harrowing account of the spill paints a grim picture. But now, 5 years later, we caught up with a much happier Frank to see what he has to say about the current state of Gulf seafood. Frank, it is hard to believe that it's been 5 years since we sat down together on that first Louisiana Eats to talk about the terrible things that we were being inundated with the BP oil spill having just happened and the oil was washing ashore. And it really looked at the time as though our entire existence was threatened again. But luckily, there's kind of a happy ending, huh?
Well, I think 5 years later, we're in much better shape, for sure. You know, we must always remember that the Macondo rig explosion was a terrible, terrible tragedy. And I always think about the 12 people that lost their lives and their families. We can't forget that.
No.
And as Gulf Coast residents, you know, we all know that, you know, hundreds of thousands of livelihoods were impacted, my own included and yours too. But, you know, we are lucky. We're resilient, we're strong, and we believe in ourselves. And this whole area, Louisiana, Gulf Coast, we don't give up.
And yeah, we're tough.
5 years later, we've seen the miracles that nature performs every day, and we're in pretty good shape.
So from a chef's point of view, what do you see the seafood scene being in Louisiana now? Other than seasonal shortages, or are you experiencing any kind of difference from before and now?
Well, I don't think so. We're getting everything we need. I spent a lot of my working life sourcing what we use here in the restaurant, and seafood is certainly the most challenging puzzle that there is because of the nature of it. You know, while seafood is perhaps the main wild food that we eat. And so you have to be knowledgeable and flexible and know the market and be able to roll with it. And I've always done that. And, you know, I pay close attention to where my stuff's from, what's the quality, what's best. If someone asks me what kind of fish I bought today, I say BA fish, best available. I don't go by species, I go what's best. And we're getting the beautiful stuff, gorgeous shrimp. Oysters are fabulous.
Trout jumping in the boats.
Yeah, yeah. Fishing reports are good. It's a wonderful thing.
I think that the fishermen themselves have rebounded in a better way, too. A lot of them, through Katrina and then the BP oil spill, they kind of had to teach themselves new tricks, and they have.
Probably so. I mean, you talk about resilience. Our fishing communities are the epitome of resilience because they feel so strongly about their livelihoods. You know, like I know, none of our fishermen want to go up the road,
no,
quote unquote, for any reason other than to see a doctor.
Right.
So they don't want a land job. They want to be out on the water doing what they've been doing for generations. And they find ways to get that done. And very flexible people. Many of them roll with the seasons. A lot of our fin fishermen are getting ready for shrimp season as we speak. Late April is the time when local fin fish actually gets a little tight, but that's because the fishermen are getting their boats ready for shrimp season, which opens next month.
One of the things that angered me 5 years ago, the blogging, the nastiness, the horrible negative pushback, people did not understand how meticulously careful we are about our seafood safety. Have you experienced any pushback? Did you have some of it at first? And does anybody question you about that now?
We certainly did have that in the first couple of years. I think public perception, people are quick to judge. You know, I was never, ever, ever concerned about the safety of the food that we serve. Ever, not one day. My concern was more an environmental and ecological impact on future generations of our crabs and shrimp. And that's sort of an intangible that's difficult to measure. So much of our fishing waters was closed to fishing. So we were forced to source seafood from elsewhere. We couldn't get oysters for 9 months, so I started serving squid from the East Coast. In the Brightson family, our number one Thanksgiving tradition is mom's oyster dressing at Thanksgiving. And 2010 was the one year in my entire life we did not have it.
Oh.
That's 1 year out of 59 years. Not having oysters was really tough. You know, no oyster po' boys, no oysters in the gumbo, no fried oysters. I mean, that was big. So I had to think of something to replace that, and I came upon the idea of using fried calamari. And I was getting beautiful domestic squid from Rhode Island. So on our fried seafood platter, you had fried fish, fried shrimp, and fried squid. And it was popular, and people started asking for it as an appetizer. So we eventually put on fried calamari as an appetizer, and it stayed to be a very popular thing even after the oysters came back. And the other thing I did was our unfried seafood platter, or what we call here at Brightson's the Shell Beach diet. it does have baked oysters on the half shell, usually one or two different kinds. And so I needed something to replace that. And that was difficult until I tried it with scallops. And let me tell you something, baked scallops Rockefeller is killer. Anything I did with oysters on the half shell, I could do with scallops. You know, nice, sweet, dry scallops. And oftentimes in cooking, great ideas don't come out of the blue like some Picasso-inspired vision of something no one's ever seen before. Oftentimes, my ideas come out of necessity and being resourceful. And so, you know, scallops have stayed part of our repertoire here at Brightson's. You know, we still do them a couple of different ways. And it's fun to expand your horizons a little bit, too. You know, our food is part of our culture and part of our lives, and we have a very strong emotional attachments to certain things like crab meat, you know, and for us to have crab meat ravigote at one of the great Creole restaurants, shrimp remoulade, those are, I think, beacons of progress for us. You know, wild-caught shrimp are the best in the world, and it's an annual crop. It comes every year, you know, and like clockwork, and then that's something that we look forward to with great anticipation. And for me, to be able to serve Creole classics like trout meuniere, shrimp remoulade, baked oysters on the half shell, that means the world to me. The second major impact was public perception. And, you know, how easy is it for people to say, no, I'll just eat something else? Or more importantly, no, I'll just go to my vacation somewhere else rather than the Gulf Coast. Again, an intangible but significant damage to the Gulf Coast. Hopefully, 5 years later, all that has played out and people are being realistic and enjoy one of the finest areas in America.
Absolutely. Well, I hope when they come visit one of the finest areas in America, they come visit one of the finest chefs in America, you, Chef Frank Brightston at Brightston's Restaurant. Thank you, Frank.
Thank you, Poppy. Always a pleasure.
Chef Frank Brightston of Brightston's Restaurant.
Say it's all right. It's all right. Say it's all right.
It's all right.
It's all right. Have a good time, 'cause it's all right.
When we come back from a short break, Rusty Godet of LSU's Sea Grant program joins us to report on the remarkable new innovations happening in the seafood industry today. Have you ever heard of Nano Ice? Stay tuned.
Now listen to the beat. Kind of patch of feet. You got soul. And everybody knows that it's all right. Whoa, it's all right. When you wake up
early. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's.
Eating oysters in Louisiana is a major part of our culture here. Whether it's raw or fried or now char-grilled, the oyster industry is it's probably not as huge as other aspects of the different food industries, but it's a very important one and it employs a lot of people and packs a lot.
This is seafood quality specialist Dr. John Bell in 2010, sharing his thoughts on what it will take for Louisiana's oyster industry to recover.
The environmental part, that's really the bigger question, and I don't think anybody has one answer for that. How things are going to change for the better as we try to restore our wetlands are going to have a significant impact not only on the oyster harvester and the business, but also on the rest of us consumers who like to eat oysters. That needs to be taken into consideration like many other factors as we move forward to restore our coastlines. There are some oyster reefs out in our wetlands that have been there for centuries. It's really just unique parts of nature, if you will. The existence of those reefs and the continued existence of those reefs should be a consideration in the master plan when they come to determining where river diversions might be and those type of issues. It was really interesting to hear him talk. It was something I'd never realized myself. These are just wondrous, you know, reefs and the collections of oysters. Recently read a report where a very large percentage of the world's oyster reefs no longer are in existence. So it really is a timely topic.
How does the oyster spat affect the restoration?
Well, again, this is just from my understanding of listening to oyster biologists and wetland experts talk. But the main idea is it does two things. It'll form a structure, actually reefs, and that'll have some impact on water movement and can actually afford some protection to growing plants as we're trying to build land. So that's one aspect. And the second one is they filter water. I mean, that's how they grow. That's what they do. They clean up water, and that can have a big impact on helping the environment, nourishing not only the wetlands and the growing grasses, but provide cover for fish and other environments, other animals. So it produces benefits in many ways, but specifically for the restoration, I think is producing some structure that will help with the growing back and building land.
Something I learned about recently is an oyster hatchery that's opening up on Grand Isle, and it's just brand new and coming on board. Tell us about a plan for an oyster hatchery on Grand Isle.
From my understanding, they really added a couple focuses to what they were doing. They're always doing oyster research and trying to support the industry in the biological aspects. But one thing they're doing, Dr. Supan, is as an outgrowth of some of this research, they've been able to develop oysters that will grow fat and not reproduce during the summer months. So this provides an opportunity for interested fishermen, so it's focusing on the fishermen in the industry, the harvesters, to be able, if they want to try and produce that type of oyster during the summer months. That's really kind of nascent right now. I think there's one or two guys attempting it here. They're also working on it in Alabama. But that's an exciting issue for the hatchery to focus on directly helping the industry.
Is this a genetically modified oyster?
It's the traditional crossbreeding. Okay, let me make sure I get this right. It has triploid, meaning it has three sets of chromosomes instead of two. So that means that it's sterile. So instead of putting energies in reproducing, it just grows. Personally, I don't want to see the oyster industry go away. I don't think anybody wants to. It's just going to have to adapt as it has in the past.
And how has the industry adapted? We spoke with Rusty Godet from LSU's Sea Grant program about the amazing innovations that are now being put into practice in Louisiana's seafood industry. Rusty, I love having you as our resident seafood specialist. And I wanted to take this opportunity on the anniversary of the BP oil spill to talk about the good news that when it comes to Louisiana seafood these days, and there's nobody better than you to do it. Tell me a happy story, because that's what I'm here to hear.
Well, the happy story actually starts with a calamity that we all remember, being Katrina. During Katrina, 85% of the fishery harvest fleet was disabled in some way, shape, or form. And because we knew there would be compensatory funds coming in, we decided that we would try and make the fishery harvest sector a better place rather than just bring it up to the status that it was before Katrina or pre-Katrina.
When you start with almost a blank slate there, you all made the decision and the investment to decide to rebuild better and smarter this time, right?
Correct. We were trying to empower the fishery people, the harvesters, the buyers, the processors, and even the retailers, to present a much better product. The entire game has changed on fishery products to where quality is paramount. If you do not have quality, then you have very little chance of making a decent living.
Now, we know that you can catch a quality product in the waters surrounding Louisiana.
Correct. We have some of the best fishery products, both shellfish and finfish, that are available worldwide. But the problem is that fishery product is at its best when it's swimming around in the Gulf or in the estuarine waters or even in the freshwater. As soon as that fishery product is caught, is harvested, then the quality begins to degrade. And there's only a few things that you can do to minimize the degradation of that product post-harvest. And the biggest thing that is used to try and maintain that high quality is the cold chain.
The cold chain.
The cold chain is basically that every step of the way from the time that product is harvested to it's put in somebody's mouth is got to be a continuous, rigid, fairly consistent pattern of refrigeration. Refrigeration is one of the primary ways that we are able to slow down the degradation, whether it be bacterial degradation or enzymatic degradation.
What is enzymatic degradation?
Well, things like in a shrimp, you would have the hepatopancreas or the fat that we have in crawfish.
The pink stuff.
the pink and yellow stuff that's inside. And even though you would keep that animal clean bacteriologically, then the enzymes that are created in that tissue begin to degrade the surrounding tissue in that. So the cold chain does minimize that. In some cases, it doesn't stop it, but the colder you bring it, you can go even into the frozen product, but enzymatic degradation sometimes continues in frozen product to where you really have to bring it way, way, way down. The closer to absolute zero that you can get, the better it is.
So what are some of the innovations that you all have brought on board since Katrina and the BP oil spill? Because you're constantly innovating and constantly bringing new things into the fisherman's purview.
After Katrina, we were dead set that we understood that quality was the number one principle that we had to pursue. That includes harvest times. That includes holding times on the boat, on board, and on onshore processing. All of these things have to be addressed just as they are equally weighted in the end quality product. So the first thing that comes to mind is that we wanted to try and make the product a more profitable entity for the fishermen. And again, you have to have quality for that product to be a profitable venture. So we started looking at the cold chain and saying, this is one thing. It's not just ice.
Yeah.
You know, ice is nice. Ice is nice, but, you know, there's a lot of other things that are even nicer. And you get into plate freezing. You get into brine freezing. You get it. And it's a matter of just sensitizing the harvest sector to what they are doing and making them understand that if you do this, you have a much higher quality product. And we have to get the buying people to give them the premium for that quality product. If they have the ability to sell premium with no extra cost incentive as trash,
right,
then it's not going to work.
Exactly.
So
think more and more in today's market, people are recognizing and valuing a premium product?
Absolutely. You cannot, as we say, you know, today's shrimper cannot shrimp like his grandfather did.
Right.
It's a different game. The quality of the product that is coming in from overseas, both cultured and wild caught, is so high that if you come in with compromised product, thermally abused product, then you have no chance of getting a premium price for that particular product.
So walk us through, there, I'm sure listeners who can't imagine what a plate freezer is. So let's go through the various pieces of equipment that now are available to Louisiana's fishermen.
The technology that is used in some of the gas-driven refrigeration or freezing, like the nitrogen freezers or the carbon dioxide freezers, those things are turning them into rock-hard product at minus whatever,
mm-hmm.
And very, very quickly. The game is to get the heat out of the product.
And the waters are warm in Louisiana.
The waters are warm here. And so it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out, you know, from warm water, our warm waters are very productive, but they're also teeming with bacterial life that will quickly degrade the product. So the game is to get the heat out of the product. Pre-Katrina, we used to try and get people to understand that if they used the ice slurry, they mm-hmm. could strip the heat out of the product and then go to their conventional freezing or cooling, then go to flake ice. But now what we have is different technology that just literally pulls the heat out of the product and gets it to that target temperature.
It's superior to an ice slurry.
It's superior to ice lure. We have new things such as nano ice, which is
nano ice. Now let's just start at the top with the nano ice and explain this.
Well,
to
nano
me.
Is very small, and ice is just nano ice that is in microscopic size particles that maximizes the contact area between the ice crystals and the product that it's taking the heat out of. And nano ice, we got to see this at a conference in Oregon. This was last October. And this stuff has a tremendous advantage is that it can be made from seawater. So
really? So they can make this nano ice on board?
They can make it on board as they're steaming to their respective harvest sites instead of having ice holes where they load up with ice and then go on a constant loss situation to their harvest
grounds. Besides, then you have to buy the ice. But this way, once you've got the nano ice maker,
right.
There's all that water in the sea.
And this, it's about, if you could imagine, it's about the consistency of a unflavored icy or unflavored slushy,
cool.
Except it's even finer. And so it's you can make peaks in it. You know,
uh-huh.
Like that. You know, it's not like flake ice or something. And then you move into more traditional things like brine freezing, and all of those things are good. And that's why I said it's a blend of traditional or pre-existent technology and some new things that are going on that we're trying to expose the fishermen to. And many of them are adopting to it because they recognize and are paid for the extra quality that a strong cold chain will allow for.
Rusty Godet of LSU's Sea Grant Program. How important is temperature when you're handling fresh fish at home? We'll answer that question when we come right back. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. How important is temperature when you're handling fresh fish at home? Every degree that your fish warms to as it travels from the grocery to the frying pan makes a huge difference in quality. There are a lot of little things that you may not have thought of, like select your fish last before checking out of the grocery store. And if you're not going straight home, have an ice chest in your car, especially if the travel time from the store to your refrigerator is an hour or more. Once you get it home, keep it in the coldest part of your refrigerator because fish should be stored at 32 degrees. Also, it's a good idea to store the fish covered in ice and eat that fish in 48 hours or less. Also, leave it in the fridge until you're ready to put it in the pan. I'm Poppy Tooker, and fresh fish on your dinner table is real Louisiana Eats. In the last segment, we heard about how new fishing practices have improved the quality of seafood coming out of the Gulf. But there's another way that fishermen have adapted to the Gulf after the spill, by selling trash. No, not garbage. Trash fish, I mean. Trash fish are fish caught in shrimping nets by accident, and in the past, they were thrown overboard, hence their name, trash fish.
But now fishermen and restaurants alike are cashing in and making one man's trash everyone's treasure. We talked to shrimper Lance Nacio and chef Darren Nesbitt to hear how trash fish are being utilized every day in the kitchens of Dickie Brennan's restaurants.
I'm Lance Nacio, owner and operator of Anna Marie Seafood, and bycatch is some unintended species that we produce while we're harvesting shrimp, you know, because we're pulling a net through the water, and we catch whatever's in the water, and we have gear in there to help reduce the amount of bycatch, but you still pull up unintended bycatch. And bycatch is anything other than what you're targeting, you know, which we pull up crabs, sardines, croaker, you know, all kinds of things like that. But there is bycatch that, you know, people really enjoy to eat that they don't get a chance to eat. And some of the stuff is like flounder or Atlantic whiting, drumfish, sheep's head, you know, things like that that we legally we can keep aboard, and we process it and try to bring it out over to Bourbon House.
Well, I'm Darren Nesbitt. I'm the executive chef of Bourbon House. Bourbon House specifically features seafood. We're very excited to partner up with Lance. He's a very interesting individual in that he's got a really neat setup on his boat, and I'll let him explain that.
I have two shrimp boats, one 55-foot, one 60-foot. And the 55-foot, we have a plate freezer on it, and it's kind of a unique operation what we do. We have a mechanical sorter, a refrigerated seawater system, and we package everything for market while we're harvesting, literally out of the water. And, you know, different things that we're able to sell, save commercially. Incidentally, we catch, you know, drumfish, sheep's head, triple tail. We preserve soft shell shrimp. Atlantic whiting is another one we catch. And some of these things we're able to preserve with the freezer. And then we sell them at either at farmers markets or at the Bourbon House.
I would love for you to explain how the mechanical sorter works. And I also want to know more about, what did you call it, the sea chiller? What was that?
Well, the mechanical sorter is a piece of equipment that comes from Nova Scotia. And we, you know, the shrimp normally is harvested at sea, and it makes it to a processor, and they have mechanical sorters there. But we have this little bitty compact one that fits on the deck of the boat. So we're able to adjust the sizes that it'll grade for us. It grades out four different sizes. So it's a very valuable piece of equipment that we use. And then once we sort them with the sorter, we put them in what's called a refrigerated seawater system. My boat, when it leaves, it carries no ice aboard. It's just plate freezers and a refrigerated seawater system that is at 35 degrees. We use seawater and get it really cold. So once we sort our catch, we chill it, and then we weigh it, box it, and load it in this plate freezer. And one of them is at minus 45 degrees Fahrenheit, and the other one is at 38 to 40 below zero. And everything sits on a plate until it's fully frozen.
Explain to me how you all handle what's known as trash fish. So the sorting's going on. Does this sorter automatically sort of spit out what isn't a shrimp?
No, really, Poppy. You know, what we do is we pass our shrimp sometimes through what's called a salt tank. And what it does, it floats out any unwanted bycatch. And we actually pull gear to reduce the amount of bycatch. And we've been doing it for a long time. We pull TEDs in our skimmers, which is a turtle excluder device, but it also helps us get rid of any unwanted bycatch, such as sharks or bigger fish that, you know, may make it into the tail bags. Different types of rays it gets rid of out of our nets, you know. And unfortunately, we do lose some of the good trash fish that we would want to save by using this. But, you know, our operation, it's got to be really efficient for all the work we do. So whenever we pull our haul, we don't want to have too much unintended catch, you know, because it makes better quality and easier handling when we do that.
The bycatch situation with the Gulf of Mexico shrimpers has given us a bad image, sort of, in the rest of the country. Would you talk about how you see that situation and why it's so important to you to change it?
Well, you know, it's just all about perception. Just like the Monterey Bay thing we have going on, we've been red listed because there's a prohibition on TED enforcement through our local agents. But the industry is in compliance, and you know, it's just like the bycatch issue. You know, they think we're going out there and catching 7 or 8 pounds of bycatch to every pound of actual catch. But you know, we run a really clean operation with these things we're using to try and get rid of the bycatch. And I would invite anybody any day to come aboard my boat, and you know, we probably produce 10 to 1 shrimp versus bycatch.
Has your bycatch device use caused any level of loss in your total shrimp catch?
You know, there is some loss, but you know, the loss is minimal when it comes to the fact that we're able to handle it much quicker and bring in a much better quality product.
How did the dialogue begin between you and Darren about your bycatch?
Well, I was reached out last year about them coming out and seeing my operation. They came out, and it was 4 chefs, and it was a total of, I think, 14 people. And I, you know, showed them the operation and cooked some shrimp for them, and, you know, everything went over really well, and we showed them all the different stuff we were saving, you know, types of bycatch and stuff, and they were really interested in what we had to offer. And we started in the fall of last year, and, you know, the relationship worked really well last year, and I'm really looking forward to this year, you know, because when we started doing business was kind of like at the tail end of our season. So, you know, we have a whole year to look forward to. In the second boat, I'm putting a freezer on it next month. So the amount of product we're able to deliver should literally double.
Darren, I'd like to hear from your perspective why you, as the corporate chef for Dickie Brennan, decided to tackle the bycatch.
I think from a restaurant perspective, it's important, or at least interesting, to see a variety of fish on the menu. You know, we've gotten so kind of locked into redfish and drum, you know, tuna. So for someone to see flounder or whiting or and, you know, just a little variety, I think that's interesting to the consumer as well as ourselves. And I'd like to do more of that. And there's just not a lot of people specifically fishing for those fish. But the biggest thing for me was soft shell shrimp. I'm from Chicago. So, you know, my first time at Commander's touching a soft shell crab when it was alive, it scared the crap out of me. You know, and I didn't know what a soft shell crab was. And then to kind of find out that, you know, you can get soft shell shrimp. I mean, to this day, I still haven't really touched a soft shell crawfish, but I know they're out there. But Lance is a guy, and nobody else is doing that. He's hand-picking soft shell shrimp out and putting them in little Ziploc bags and saving those. So for us to get it, it's a novelty. And it's fun for the customers because I'm sure a lot of those folks are from Canada and Chicago and San Francisco. They've never seen that either. So,
Darren, if you're from Louisiana, you haven't seen a soft shell shrimp. I mean, I can't forget the first time I ever saw one. And the only reason that I saw one and ate one was because Lance showed it to me and fed it to me. So how many shrimp do you normally get, and how are you preparing them in a soft shell fashion? Because Lance, am I correct? Most other shrimpers, if they find a soft shell shrimp, they tuck it away for themselves and their families.
Yeah. You know, the soft shell shrimp, it's the shrimp is a crustacean like a crab or a crawfish, and it has to molt in order to grow. And a lot of times they're molting at night, and we do a lot of our fishing at night, so we just hand pick them out at night. You know, but a lot of it winds up do making it to the factories where the fishermen choose not to save. I mean, if you ever get fresh shrimp and you see a shrimp that doesn't look right in there, chances are it was a soft shell or a paper shell. You know, so
just to show my ignorance, you know, we get fresh shrimp quite a bit, and I always thought those little soft shell shrimp that were mixed in there were just ones that were like abused or like stuck at the bottom of the net and smashed. And so I didn't even know what it was. So to find this is really pretty exciting for us.
How do you cook them?
Well, just because our supply is limited, we don't have a lot of them. We like to sell sides, you know, maybe just 5 shrimp for guests so they get the experience of having. And we also do platters, but we just do a real light tempura batter, usually with like a beet of beer, you know.
to kind of showcase. We don't want to cover it up and heavily bread it, so it's just a light tempura so you can visibly see the shrimp. And it really, in my opinion, has a better shrimp flavor than just by eating like the tail meat, because you get everything. And I guess it's just like sucking the heads of crawfish. You get all the fat and flavor and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, to be able to just eat the shrimp head is kind of, it's weird, but it's fun. And it's delicious. It changes the flavor. It really does. So,
what has been the most challenging of the bycatch that's come in the back door?
I think for me was the squid, the calamari, because we do sell a lot of calamari, but quite honestly, it all comes in clean. So Lance gets it, but then we're, you know, picking out beaks and eyes, and, you know, it's labor intensive. I mean, it really is. And it's not that it cooks up any different or anything like that, but just because we are a high volume restaurant, to produce that much, we would have to have kind of a processing plant in the second floor or something, you know. So
I guess that means that when you're processing Lance's squid, it's sort of a labor of love then.
It is a labor of love. And, you know, honestly, we would love to get fresh local calamari, you know, exclusively. At this point, it's not a reality, though. So, but yes, a labor of love, for sure.
It would require a processor in the area, and nobody's paying that much attention to it.
And it would change the price dramatically, too, so.
So what else? Did you ever get anything in the back door that you were like, never saw this before? What is this?
I don't think so, not yet. I mean, he had some nice croakers that we, you know, especially Ben Thibodeau at Tableau, he was really interested in the croakers because he had spent some time in France, and they do a whole fish preparation. And I think he was very interested in that. I don't know what kind of croaker.
It was actually a whiting. Okay. I had sent in, yeah.
Okay. I guess for me, the biggest thing, you know, Lance has tremendous, a lot of flounder. I think that's probably the number one bycatch product. From our perspective, it's a little challenging because there's not a size necessarily. You know, he'll get, you know, pounders, pound and a quarter, pound and a half maybe. So uniformity to some extent, I mean, we're not McDonald's, you know, and it's not a cookie cutter process. But to some extent, you know, if you get two plates on the same table and one is visibly larger than the other, the guest is going to say, hey, what's up, right? So that's a little bit of a challenge, but we've come up with things on our menu. We do like a fish du jour, and, you know, we take whatever is available and just get creative. And from a chef perspective, it's fun because it gives us something on a daily basis to just really play with.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Are you like me and dream of April in Paris? Join us next week when we take a virtual trip to one of my favorite places on earth, Paris, France.
What I love about the French attitude toward cheese, and which I hope we'll see more of here, is that cheese is not a rarefied, fancy, gourmet thing for the elite. And I think we sometimes get a little worked up here about you have to know all about the milk and the grapes and the, you know, no, you can just enjoy it.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Bacardi USA and Dickie Brennan and Company. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producer Chris Kehoe and associate producers Joe Schreiner and Sarah Holtz. come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.